Support for this public radio podcast comes from the dairy families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont. On the web at go.coop.
In my kitchen, there's hard to be raining out of.
Come over here, kid, will you, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got to do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? A little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a bigger pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet. My country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
You want some more?
Delicious. And welcome to Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. How are you this evening? It's Michelle Jordan. I'll be here until 8 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in. We have returning once again one of Mouthful's former producers, Frederic Lavoisier. Thank you for being here, Frederic.
Thanks for having me.
Last time you were here, it was with a walking stick and a few other little wiggly things.
Yes, pumpkin spider.
That's right, a pumpkin spider. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And those, I'm still not over those walking sticks. They're so cool. So now, we should say, you're getting your master's degree at Sonoma State in biology.
Yes.
Biology, right, okay. Now, is your emphasis in horticulture or botany?
It's on the ecological principles of sustainable landscape design, and I'm specifically working on plants that attract beneficial insects, predators of pests.
Which is just a really cool thing. Invite the bugs over, you know? And you are now, what is your title in the certificate program we're going to talk about?
The director.
Director, okay, that's easy.
And I'm teaching one of the courses.
Uh-huh. So you've put together a program. It is a Sustainable Landscape Professional Certificate Program. I also want to introduce you, Geoff. We have Geoff Hall. What is your role in all this, Geoff?
Well, I'll be teaching the first two courses, the Ecological Principles course and the Site Design and Planning course.
Okay, cool. And I'm also inviting Mouthful's engineer, Lawrence Alberti, to join in the conversation this time. Lawrence, if you will, please, because I know that you work, your day job is sort of a related field, right?
Yep.
Do you want to say what that is?
Environmental restoration. We do wildland restoration, do a lot of creek work, that sort of thing. I can give you more on that, but it doesn't specifically pertain to what we're talking about tonight, but I do border on this topic.
Both literally and figuratively, yeah. I would think.
There you go.
So there you go. Yes, Mouthful is a show about food and wine, but also agriculture, and we wouldn't have any food and wine if it weren't for people who take care of the land. So there you go. Tell us about the overview of the program.
Okay, first of all, I would just like to make a small correction. I would love to take credit for having developed this program.
Oh, I thought you did.
And it was an idea I had at one time and had been getting myself through my master's program with fantasies about this program and how I would develop it. And I got online one day onto the Sonoma State website, and lo and behold, somebody else had already designed
this
entire
program. They were reading your mind.
And that guy, Armando Navarro, who developed the Green Building Program, left. just before it began. And so I just stepped into it, and he has set up the entire program and found all these wonderful instructors. And
Is it similar to what you would have done?
I think very similar.
Uh-huh. Well, here's something you can take absolute complete credit for. Mm-hmm. At least one of you can. Open that bottle of wine you brought. We should say, Frederick, you are French. And you have a fine appreciation for wine. Mouthful is a conversation, as if it were around a dinner table. So yes. We should enjoy wine.
I think so. And so, yes, we have this nice Rodney Strong Pinot this evening. I just enjoyed a bottle a couple nights ago with another friend, and we enjoyed it.
Yeah, I usually enjoy this. What vintage is this?
This is the 06.
And you can let that cork make as much noise as it wants to make. It's one of my favorite sound effects here on Mouthful. So it's coming. Here we go. There it was. Okay. Okay, so when does the program begin?
It begins in less than a week on the 26th, and it meets on Saturdays, and it is aimed specifically at professional gardeners, professional landscapers, designers, landscape architects. I think that we have a city planner who has signed up. The entire board of directors for, Joff better help me out here. Now I'm going to get the organization wrong. That's the American Landscape Designers.
Society of Landscape Architects.
I think that's a different organization than the one whose board of directors has signed up. I'm gonna rustle through the papers.
Okay, we've got lots of papers here in front of us.
And so we are looking for the organization. I'm going to have to find it afterwards.
Okay, that's okay. So it's starting in about a week.
It's starting on a Saturday at 8:30 in the morning.
Like, raise a glass. Congratulations. Okay. And this is the first one, right?
It's the very first one. Yes. And Joff gets to do the honors of teaching the first course. And one of the very exciting things about this program for me is that I think all of the instructors come from fairly different backgrounds and somewhat different perspectives. And I think we all want to go to each other's classes as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is, for people who don't understand, they think of the university and the application process and, freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, master's degree, that sort of thing. This is separate. This is the extension program, right? Which is community-oriented.
Right. It's through extended education. There are a lot of continuing education courses.
Mm-hmm.
And this program is perfectly suitable for somebody you might think of as an advanced gardener, a real enthusiast. It is mainly targeted to professionals, people who have already been landscaping for a long time and would like to learn to do so in a more sustainable, regenerative way.
And so to say that, another way of saying that would be you expect people to know certain principles and how to do a number of things. There's a certain amount of knowledge assumed.
We're hoping that they have had their hands in the soil at some point in their lives.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think that that's strictly necessary.
Oh, okay.
I think somebody could come and take a lot from this program.
Okay, because I don't want to scare anyone off if, like somebody like me.
No, someone like you, would get a lot from this.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about what ecological principles, what that means in relationship to a discreet space around someone's house or a winery.
Well, some of the principles that we'll be looking at in our first class, for instance, are observing natural systems and learning what we can from looking at the forests and the ecosystems and the naturally occurring environments around us and seeing what lessons can be learned and how we can apply those lessons to create sustainable landscapes. I think a big part of the challenge of sustaining neighborhoods and communities and sustaining a resource base for our children and for future generations is going to be looking at how can we take our land use ethic and our land development principles and take them from the highly consumptive and polluting end of the spectrum and move them to the highly productive and the filtering end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm.
Now, it seems to me that one of the main ways people have looked at the landscape for a long time is sort of slash and burn. Yeah, you've got, say, a big rectangle of land. You get rid of everything that's on it, and you plow it up, and then you try to make it submit to your will by planting the things that you want to grow. And one of my first, certainly there's lots of options to that in West County where I live, but that seems to be, you're driving along and you see somebody building a new space or landscaping, that's what you see. And the first time I was really exposed to someone talking about an alternative to that was with, I think it was Michael Presley, and this was when you were producing, at TaylorMade Farms, and we went for a walk. And he took me up and he talked about the big mammals that would walk along and they'd be pooping on the path and eating the berries and then the animals that would come along behind them. And it was very organic. I hate to use that as a cliche, but it was very, it just seemed so earthy and so natural. And I was like, oh, you can put a little something there. You can harvest those berries. You can maybe move that. It was like, follow the big mammals. I thought that was, does any of that come in?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a big part of developing sustainable landscaping has to do with recognizing when you have something already really worth keeping and worth saving. All these beautiful, huge oak trees even, and the ecosystems that spread out around them are already contain a huge amount of value in terms of landscaping and site development and just resources. And part of this challenge of sustainable landscaping is recognizing when you just want to protect an area as opposed mm-hmm. to develop it and keep it in place and take special measures to make sure that construction activities or development activities don't impact these special areas and that they can be incorporated into landscapes or gardens or at least be part of the boundary, or that we keep connections between these different ecosystems intact. That's a really important concept. The more we divide up and chunk out ecosystems and some of the existing natural habitats, the less sustainable these become and the more vulnerable they become to the pressures of development and basically decline.
I have to ask you a question about something that happened to me yesterday. Anyone jump in? And maybe it means nothing, but I was walking outside to get some firewood, and there was a volunteer walnut tree that grew up out of my compost, and it's gotten, I think I even like cut it down one year and it's back, so I figure it wants to grow, and it doesn't have any leaves on it right now. But I walked out and there were about 15 or 16 turkey vultures sitting on it. And I wondered what that meant about my landscape practices.
It means your volunteer walnut's gotten big.
Yeah, it's big. It's big. But what attracts turkey vultures?
Dead animals, right?
I was going to say something that you're keying in on are large trees and just tall trees. And this is a really important piece of creating habitat. And either, like we were talking about, preserving the tall trees that are in your development or planting new legacy trees that will grow up over the decades are a really important component to habitat, to bringing in large birds like vultures, and even perhaps more importantly from a predatory standpoint, owls and raptors.
I've been trying to get owls to move in for a long time. He hasn't come back.
Maybe after that walnut tree's gotten a little bigger.
When you're deciding to plant tall trees, for example, and how about if we focus on West County? Can we agree? And am I right? West County was, Western Sonoma County, this Bastopol area and west, was a rainforest at one point. How do you choose what trees are appropriate? What sort of resources do people have? I assume that's going to be something that they learn in the program. Like, should you not plant Monterey pines because it's the wrong climate? I mean, how do you know those things?
Well, I don't plant Monterey pines.
Yeah.
They grow in Monterey, and we purchased a property that had Monterey pines
on it. And I had
it.
Monterey pines where I was, and I cut them down.
And but perhaps if Lawrence does restoration, he must know a lot about the history of land use in Sebastopol.
Well, what I know is there's a lot of education that goes into that decision-making process, mm-hmm. that people study for a long time, the historical occurrence of different species of trees. And
are they able to find that out? Do you have to go back into archives and
old photographs? I think you use all the tools at your disposal.
Can you find out by studying the soil in any way?
I would assume that's an aspect of it.
Uh-huh.
Sure.
What else?
That's sort of beyond my...
Okay.
You know, I'm told what to plant. Someone else makes that decision for me.
Uh-huh.
But I've watched the process for quite a while.
Uh-huh.
And we know that, you know, of course, in the Occidental area, you have a lot of the big... we have redwoods,
right.
for one thing.
Yeah.
You know, big drip factor there, produce the water in the area. And I assume that goes back, you know, predates the humans in the area because of the age of those trees.
Mm-hmm.
With oaks, I think there are less oaks that have that historical significance, that historical background. What am I trying to say? You can't cut down a... No, I'm going the wrong direction with that.
But oak trees aren't as long-lived. Oak trees live about 150, 160 years.
And we've seen that, you know, a lot of those have been cleared out, of course, by the agricultural practices in western Sonoma County. So, you know, I'm sure you guys probably both speak to this a little better than I can.
Yeah, when you're considering what large tree is appropriate to plant or where to plant large trees, you know, you're going to take a lot of very site-specific considerations into account. For instance, how is a tall tree going to affect the sunlight on your property? You're not going to plant tall trees on the southern end of your property and end up blocking all your key winter light. You also want to consider your neighbors. You don't want to be, if you're in tight proximity with many of your neighbors, it's helpful to consider the whole community, the whole neighborhood, and not block the direct southern winter sunlight from your neighbors necessarily. So a lot of site-specific considerations go into play. Often the northern end of your property where you're not going to be concerned about blocking a great degree of your winter solar gain is a good place to look for planting large trees. If you've got larger properties, of course, you'd be able to plant more large trees. But when it comes to sustainable landscaping, you're really looking at whole system planning. So it's about how you relate and connect everything. So you're looking at your neighbor's property, you're looking at your solar gain, you're looking at...
What do you mean by solar gain?
Oh, well, I'm talking about especially the sunlight that you get during the winter, which is really important for growing and for gardeners and for landscaping and even for heating your house or for heating your infrastructure. Landscaping more and more is being related, for instance, to the energy design of buildings. So when you're planting tall trees, you can look at factors like whether or not that tree is evergreen or it's deciduous. So deciduous trees, you might be able to plant in your south or especially your southwestern exposure where you'll be benefiting from some shade in the summer when the plant when the tree has leaves.
And then it loses its leaves.
And it loses its leaves.
Comes through in the winter.
And the sunlight comes through in the winter, exactly.
A principle.
Yeah. And it actually, it was interesting to me that we've had this green building program at Sonoma mm-hmm. State, which is a year-long program. We've had that program for several years now, and it's been interesting to me how long it's taken for people to sort of look out the window. And here they are building these buildings that are green and hadn't really connected the landscape to that or made those connections throughout neighborhoods or to the wildlands that are beyond. And we finally looked out the window, I think, and decided, oh, we have to do something out here And one thing I'd like to say about trees, and you know, we could talk all night just about native plants, but I think when you're talking about trees is when it's especially important to be thinking about natives. If you plant an annual and it's not that well adapted to our climate or environment here, well, it only lives one season and it's not a huge deal. But if you plant a tree that is not going to be happy here, you are going to struggle with it.
For years, for decades, maybe.
Right. And so things like, you know, planting birches, for instance, and I love birches.
I planted three at my house when I first moved in.
Yes, and I love quaking aspen. Quaking aspen, though, want to grow in the Sierras around 8,000 feet. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you have to take into account what sort of trees want to grow in this particular environment.
How do you feel, then, about eucalyptus trees?
Oh, that's such a tough question. When I look out of my second floor window, there's a huge grove of eucalyptus, and there is a red-tailed hawk nest in that eucalyptus every year. And eucalyptus trees provide some incredible habitat for some birds, for the monarch butterflies, which seem to like them a lot. But we do associate them with our California landscape, but they don't belong here. I think I hated it as much as anyone when they cut down that big row of eucalyptus.
On 116.
You know which ones I'm talking about.
And they've cut a lot on Lakeville. They're still trying to save that Lakeville corridor, but they're going.
Right. But when eucalyptus are reseeding places like in Annandale State Park, and I see that they're coming through and taking them out and burning them, I applaud that.
It doesn't have to be black and white.
I don't think I'm radical enough to go through and take out every eucalyptus tree in California right now. And I don't know. How do you feel about
it? Well, I think I would totally mirror that opinion. I think it's a great attitude. You know, in some cases, eucalyptus trees are providing great habitat. Again, this is a great big giant tall tree, so you often see raptors and owls and vultures and all kinds of birds habitating these tall trees and nesting in them. In some cases, as Frederic was mentioning, you see them in riparian coastal parks where they're really kind of taking over and impacting native habitats. So in some cases, you know, I think it's appropriate to go through and maybe see if we can remove them and restore native habitats. But in some places, you know, it's not very black and white. We can't just go ahead and demonize plants or trees just because we think they're not native or they don't belong here. I think every case warrants consideration. And this is, you know, again, goes to really site-specific issues.
You're listening to Mouthful on KRCB.
Corn yellow and tall. If the summer rains were kindly, we'd have a harvest in the fall. You have been my true companion since the day our love was young. Darling, stay beside me and walk.
Nice song. Peter Rowan and Tony Rice. Thank you, Lawrence, for that suggestion. We are talking with Frederic Lavoie-Pierre, Director of the Sustainable Landscape Professional Certificate Program at the Sonoma State University School of Extended Education. Also joining us, Joff Hall, who is teaching some of the sessions. Lawrence brought up a really good question while we were listening to that music. What is it? What does sustainable mean in this context? Sustainable is one of those words like organic, local, you know, all these words that are so bandied around that your ear just sort of glosses over them in a lot of ways. So what does it mean really?
Well, I'm going to let Joff take this because he's doing the first class.
Well, let's see. Sustainable, I think, is a word that we've heard a lot. It goes only so far to describe the challenge ahead of us, but I briefly mentioned it before. We're talking about how do we look at our land use ethic and principles and go from a model that is highly consumptive of resources and somewhat polluting and go to a model that is highly productive, producing resources and filtering. So a word that I like actually that goes beyond sustainable is ecological or regenerative. I like the word ecological because we're looking at ecos, which is Latin for home, the study of home, which is bringing the whole human element and the environmental element together. In my years of doing ecological design in Northern California and Sonoma County, I think the one thing that really consistently people get very excited about is edible and functional landscaping. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, this is a key part of how we're going to meet the challenge of sustaining healthy communities when it comes to nutrition and food and sustaining a resource base for our children and for future generations. So including functional plants in the landscape and especially plants that provide food and medicine and fuel and fiber and timber, people get very excited about this, and it's been a very fun part of our practice, and it really brings people outside. It gets them connected with their gardens. It connects people in the community. And let's face it, everybody who's had the opportunity or the privilege of biting into a piece of fruit from their garden, like a pear or a strawberry or blueberries or raspberries or produce or vegetables from their neighbors or from their local CSA, knows that this is just a superior quality product. It just tastes crisp, and the texture and the color, the fragrance is just all there. And nutritionally, it's just it's feeding us much better.
Now, how do we make this cross? I'm going to use a word that we're told doesn't apply to this country, and of course it does. Class boundaries. You know, we have people who have enough disposable income to have a landscaper or a garden, and we have people that can barely afford rent, utilities, and gas. So how, I mean, does the economics of sustainable landscaping and the feasibility of incorporating it in every level of society, is that anything that's addressed in the program?
I think that certainly, that is one of the aspects of sustainability.
Economics. Yeah.
And, interestingly, sometimes it's the people who have all the money and can afford the landscape designers who don't really care about growing food, mm-hmm. Whereas if you're living a little close to your pocketbook, it makes sense to have a half a dozen chickens and a small vegetable garden, and perhaps easier to implement that.
Mm-hmm.
I heard an idea the other night I really enjoyed that actually a designer mentioned about a neighborhood he had been in, and somebody had this tree, I think it was a peach tree, and put in their front yard and put a sign out when peaches were ripe, take all you want, and mm-hmm. the neighbors could come by and take peaches. And he was talking about this idea that if everybody on a block just planted a different fruit tree.
Absolutely.
In their
yes.
front yard, you don't have to be even growing large quantities of your mm-hmm. own food, but some. And mm-hmm. I think, as Joff was saying, that you get this connection to what you're growing and what you're eating, and it helps you learn and makes you want to grow more.
Absolutely. It does.
Hearing those stories reminds me of two of, I think, the most sustainable landscaping examples that I can remember, actually, are both coming from people who are starting with very little and with very little resources. One in Long Beach, There are a lot of oil drilling and that sort of activity going down in the area, and actually a heavily contaminated site once the oil company was done pulling the oil out of the earth there. There was essentially a brownfield left, and just by coincidence, accidentally, landscapers and local people started dumping their green waste on this vacant lot. And this started happening for actually several months and even years, and huge amounts of vegetative debris collected there. And what they eventually decided to do was just chip it all up and spread it all out on this old brownfield that was basically polluted with hydrocarbons, petroleum byproducts.
Oil, right?
And now I've got wonderful slides of this place. It's a beautiful community garden. And in fact, spreading this huge amount of vegetative debris over this whole area brought in the right soil habitat to actually clean up hydrocarbons.
Really? How does that work? I mean, technically, can we say?
Technically, we can use mushrooms and fungi, which are extremely effective at actually cleaning up hydrocarbon pollution, petroleum-based pollution, and converting it back into very viable and healthy soil. And that's exactly what happened in this area. And with just scraps of plastic and old pallets and anything that local people could find, they made greenhouses and garden plots and little shade houses, and it's a beautiful, thriving garden now. They've done soil tests to ensure that the soil quality has been brought back to the capability of growing healthy, productive food.
Can we talk a little bit about the mushroom?
Yes.
And how it metabolizes hydrocarbons?
Well, mushrooms are very special organisms. Mm-hmm. And
now, is it a particular mushroom, or is this just a trait mushrooms have?
Well, there are lots of different species of mushrooms mm-hmm. that could be used to clean up different types of hydrocarbon pollution. One really fun example that I know of that Paul Stamets of, what's their company, Mycomedia and Fungi Perfecti up in Washington area, actually competed in a program of bioremediation being the use of plants or animals, bacteria, fungi, to help clean up some of the big pollution problems that we're facing. And hydrocarbons are a big part of the, you know, pollutant that's out there. It's the runoff from all our parking lots and from highways and from our vehicle industry. But they used oyster mushrooms in this experiment. And you had other people who were using bacteria and other kinds of biological means to clean up soil that was saturated with diesel. But Paul Stamets plugged in a bunch of oyster mushroom mycelium into these piles of diesel-saturated soil. And within a few weeks, you had huge, giant oyster mushrooms, bigger than you would actually normally get, because actually, they were almost fertilized by the petroleum. They were actually able to molecularly change the diesel product and consume it and bring the soil back into a condition where it could grow plants. And it was not very long before maggots came in, were eating the oyster mushrooms. Birds came in to eat the maggots. They brought in bird droppings, dropped little seeds in the earth mound, and grass and green plants were growing back out of this diesel-saturated soil within months.
I hope you all listened really closely to that, because it's like the most optimistic thing. And I've known this before. You know, I've read about mushrooms' ability to do this. There have been articles in all sorts of publications. But there's something so very astonishingly wonderful about it, that every time I hear it, it's like I'm hearing it for the first time. And it takes me back to what I've felt since I became a thinking adult, which is nature's pretty wise. You know, I'm only in my lifetime going to learn a little bit of a portion of what nature knows. And it's stuff like that. It's just amazing.
Well, that's absolutely right. And nature is quite often far more effective at solving these big problems and these big pollution issues and these big resource production issues than the technologies that we end up trying to rely on or model.
Now, you know all of the really, what are they called, the big cleanup sites, they have some nasty word.
Superfund.
Superfund sites. Have any of those, have they looked at using things like mushrooms and stuff to clean up Superfund sites, and is that a possible direction?
I definitely think it's a possible direction, and I think it's still somewhat new among the thinking in terms of how to deal with these sites.
But is this a question we should be asking presidential candidates?
Sure. Yeah, oh, absolutely. Along with how we're going to shift our land use practice in general. Uh-huh. But, you know, it's a very exciting field, using plants and fungi and animals to help deal with some of these big issues. You know, even, for instance, they were looking at the turkey tail mushroom, another potential mushroom for cleaning up. I think it was rocket fuel, another hydrocarbon pollution that, you know, you see in these big military bases that are all throughout mm-hmm. the Bay Area that we're trying to restore and figure out and reinvent new uses for.
Now, one of the things that if you want to put on a really cynical hat briefly, mm-hmm. I don't like to wear it too often, but if you do, you might ask the question, is there a lot of money to be made from cleaning things up this way? And maybe there isn't, so maybe that's why it doesn't get, you know, examined a little more.
You know, I think it's just there's such new ideas.
Okay, so it's new.
And, you know, ultimately, I mean, we live in America. And so if you can show somebody a way that they can earn money doing something that's regenerative, then that's the best thing of all. Because if we say, look, we have this wonderful regenerative technology and we can deal with this pollution, but it's going to cost us a heap of money, it's very hard to sell that idea mm-hmm. to the American public. And so we want these technologies to be able to support people. You know, one thing I wanted to mention, I have a bit of a problem with the word sustainable, because really the definition is that we're trying to maintain things at some kind of status quo. And you know, the word regenerative is more evocative, I think, of what a lot of people are trying to do now. Mm-hmm. We're not trying to sustain a piece of land in some poor ecological condition. Mm-hmm. You know, we're trying to regenerate.
Yeah, that, I think that's a really good point. That's a really good point. Sustainable means to keep as it is.
Right, and there are a lot of things we really should not be sustaining.
Yeah, absolutely. You're listening to Mouthful, the discussion this evening, the Sustainable Landscape Professional Certificate Program at Sonoma State, and, as always, related issues. It's Mouthful. It's Michelle Jordan. It is KRCB. Thanks for tuning in. To tell you, this certificate program we're talking about, Sustainable Landscape Professional Certificate Program, you don't have to sign up for the whole thing. The entire project, which goes from January 26th through June 21st, costs $900. But you know what? And that's a great deal for ending up with your certificate in this field. But if there's a particular issue you feel deficient in, if there's something, maybe you have interesting water patterns and you want to have a garden, but the way the water moves through your property makes it more difficult than you know how to deal with. You can sign up for any one of the courses, ecological principles, site development, soil resources, water resources, plants, operation and maintenance. Oh, maintenance, that's right. You have to keep it up. Each one of those classes is available, and you don't need a professional. You don't need to be a professional, and you don't. There are no prerequisites other than interest. So there you go. Learn how to be a better gardener. I just have to say, I'm a really terrible gardener, probably mostly because I don't have time, really. I don't think that I'm a total klutz. But this year, just because I got so frustrated with not being able to get the lettuce that I wanted, I bought some plants, and I thought, well, I'm going to see. And my lettuce is growing in the winter in my raised beds. And I also have cilantro, which I can't grow in the summer because it's too hot. I have cilantro, and I have Italian parsley. You just have no idea how happy it makes me to walk outside sometimes at night with my flashlight and a little pair of scissors, and I cut my lettuce and I get some cilantro and I get some parsley, and that's the core of dinner. And it just thrills me, especially that it's in the winter.
Well, I have, well, there's two points about that. One is there's something very exciting about coming home tired at the end of the day and knowing that you can get dinner in your backyard.
Yeah.
You don't have to stop at the store. And but the other point that you brought up that's interesting is that a lot of people think we can't grow anything in the winter.
That's so not true.
They've been reading too many books from cold places. And in fact, all you have to do is look around at what happens to our hills when the rains begin to see that there are lots of things that like to grow in the winter.
It turns green.
Right.
You know, it turns green. That means something. You can grow green things.
Yes. And parsley is a favorite. And even if you don't grow very very much of your food, growing herbs is a wonderful way to go.
Sometimes you need a tablespoon of minced parsley, and then you don't use it again for a few days, and you end up throwing away. And what do you pay? If you buy organic, you might be paying as much as, I don't know, $2.19, $2.59 for a bunch of parsley. And you know, good intentions aside, you end up throwing a lot of it out.
That's right. And so instead you could buy a little six-pack of parsley and then you can let it go to seed and never buy parsley again.
Unless something happens in the summer.
Well,
that's happened to me. Really? Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll check. How do people sign up for this?
They can get onto the website. It's www.sonoma.edu.
www.sonoma.edu.
Sonoma.edu/ sustainable landscape. Uh-huh. But even if they just went to sonoma.edu, they
or
could
even if you
find
went to
their
Google.
Way to extended ed. Yes, yeah. You know, if you Google sustainable landscape, Sonoma State University, it will pop right up.
Yeah. Now, tell me about the faculty.
The faculty. Well, of course, we have Joff, who could tell us a bit about himself and his business. He's going to be co-teaching the first course with Josiah Kane, who is with Rana Creek. Rana Creek has two different offices. One is down in Carmel, and the other is in Point Reyes. And they are the design company that designed the green roof at the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco. That will be how most people have heard of this company. They do a lot of restoration work. And that green roof at the California Academy is extraordinary. I think it's the biggest, I know it's the biggest one in California.
Oh, really?
Possibly the country.
Uh-huh.
And so he's teaching ecological principles and also the water resources. And you know, we've always had this idea that water is something that we need to get rid of. You know,
oh my
it
God.
Rains, we need to dig a ditch, we need to have it go somewhere else. And I think that there's a lot of new thought about that, about having the water percolate into our soil instead and catch it and mm-hmm. retain it. You know, not next to our foundation, but you don't have to get very far out from buildings to start thinking about keeping your water on mm-hmm. your land to percolate into the soil. And that will be a fascinating class. Kate Fry, who was the gardener for 18 years up at Fetzer Vineyards, grew an extraordinary garden there. And They sponsored her to go to the Chelsea Flower Show in England.
Oh, cool.
Where she totally wowed them, all these very formal British gardeners, and she planted a little wild garden. She took a lot of California wildflowers and grasses and did a little meadow and won a gold medal and met the Queen of England.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, how cool.
So she is an extraordinary gardener and knows a tremendous amount about planting for habitat,
mm-hmm.
Especially. And I'll be teaching the soils course. And Rick Taylor was recently on a panel discussion about sustainable landscaping. And he is going to be teaching our course on maintenance. And I am going to be his guest speaker that day and talk about pest management. And I think Joff should tell us about himself.
Well, my wife, Kamala Benton, and I have started Sentient Landscape, an ecological design build landscape firm here in Sonoma, in Sebastopol, in Sonoma County. We did that back in 99. We started off doing a lot of residential projects, but have recently shifted our focus to commercial and public projects. We're very excited to have designed and built the Hotel Gaia in American Canyon, just south of Napa, which is the first LEED gold rated hotel around. And we've got two more designs coming out, LEED gold hotels with the same developer. We are very excited to be working with Avalon Springs, which is an ecological, an eco village and historic hot spring. And we've been doing great consulting work with StopWaste.org in Alameda County, helping them to develop the Bay Friendly Landscaping Program.
And how do people find you? Do you have a website?
We are www.sentientlandscape.com.
S-E-N-T-I-E-N-T, sentientlandscape.com. And again, just Google Sonoma State University and sustainable landscaping. Frederick, is there a number where people should get a hold of you? Or email, whatever you prefer?
Well, they can, first of all, there is a link on the website for the program where they can email me. Otherwise, it's lavoipie@sonoma.edu. And the phone number currently is 829-0751.
That's 707-829-0751. And Frederick recommends a really great book, Plants and Landscapes for Summer Dry Climates of the San Francisco Bay Region, published by the East Bay Municipal Utility District. And it has absolutely wonderful photographs. So if you want to look more into the idea of what it is like to plant with native plants, for example, check it out. Also, there is Bay Friendly Landscape Guidelines. This is Frederick from Alameda, from the
this
Alameda
is from
Project,
Alameda,
right?
The Stop Waste.
Stop Waste. It looks really remarkable. So we've really just barely skimmed the surface of regenerative landscaping. And thanks very much to both of you. And good luck with this first year's program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, as you know, we have started a new tradition on Mouthful. As of 2008, eventually, even perhaps very soon, it will be pre-recorded. But for now, it is coming to you live. It is The Good Cook's Pantry here on Mouthful. Last week, we talked about salt. And so, of course, this week's topic is, guess what? Pepper. That is to say, Piper nigrum. All true peppercorns are fruit of this vine, which thrives near the equator. Peppercorn berries grow in loose clusters about 3 inches long. They look like little miniature Cabernet Sauvignon clusters. They have up to 100 berries on each cluster. A single vine must be picked many times in a season to harvest all its fruit. For green peppercorns, the clusters are picked in the spring before berries form hard inner cores. The best are soaked in vinegar or brine and air-dried. They have a tart, refreshing flavor. Freeze-dried green peppercorns are disappointing with a papery texture and not much flavor. Don't bother with them. Black peppercorns are harvested when the fruit is still green, but after the berries have formed a hard center. I think the best black pepper is naturally clean black pepper from Sarawak in Malaysia. These clusters are washed in hot water shortly after being picked and threshed to remove the tiny stems. The berries are dried by huge fans for 24 hours, and then they're ready for the market. Most other pepper imported into the United States is dried in the sun on straw mats for a week or two. Birds fly over it and chickens run through it. It is then sterilized using ethylene oxide. The United States is the only country still using this. It is also irradiated. The processing degrades the taste, eliminating the delicate floral aromas, and damages the environment. For white peppercorns, fruit is picked a little more ripe, but not fully red. For the best white pepper, the clusters are put into large containers and bathed with a continuous flow of spring water for about a week. In the water, the stems and the outer mantles of the berry rot away. After the water is drained, the peppercorns are rubbed to remove any remaining mantle and then dried by those large fans. The dried berries are sorted to remove dark berries and light berries. Other white pepper is made by packing clusters into sacks and soaking them in streams, rivers, or ponds. The pepper is then separated from the rotting stems, dried on straw mats, sterilized, and irradiated. It is not sorted for color or for weight. White peppercorns have a subtle fermented taste and a flavor that holds up to high heat. The volatile oils in the outer mantle, the black part of pepper, dissipate quickly into the atmosphere, which is why it is best to grind pepper just before using it and to use white pepper in cooking, as they do in Europe. Pink peppercorns are not true pepper. These faux peppercorns began showing up on menus in the 1970s and were banned briefly in the 1980s because in ridiculously large amounts they are toxic. Most pink peppercorns come from Réunion, a French-owned island in the Indian Ocean where they grow on trees native to Brazil. The bright pink berries consist of a papery outer layer and a small hard seed with a sweet, mildly aromatic flavor that can become cloying if there is too much in a dish. I get my pepper from Penzi Spices, a mail-order company that sells both black and white pepper from Malaysia, under the name Sarawak Black and Sarawak White. Be careful, though. The name is not protected, and I've come across other brands. I trust Penzi's because I was there in Kuching, the capital of Sarawak on the island of Borneo, when founder Bill Penzi placed his order. Bill doesn't agree with me that this is the best pepper in the world, but he won't argue that his company is the only source in the United States. You'll find it at penzis.com. You can request a catalog by calling 800-741-7787. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode of The Good Cook's Pantry here on Mouthful.
I stood up and with all my might I sang to the Lord, let praises be. It's time for dinner now, let's go.
Mouthful is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to mouthfuls@michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast from krcb.org or from iTunes.
Every woman, a child and man, sang to the Lord.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the 286-horsepower TL Type S with a solar-sensing climate control system. Learn more at Acura.com.